Hello and greetings to all listeners. This is John Lash. It's February 24th, 2012, and this is a special talk I'm doing with my lovely companion, Kundry, in which we're going to discuss the method of observing the organic light that anyone can practice. So the subject of our conversation in this recording is a very sacred one, because the organic light is, in one respect, the most sacred thing in the world and has been described as such by various mystics through the ages, and particularly by the alchemists of the Middle Ages. We'll come back to that illusion, I think, at some point in our conversation. So are you on board there, Kundry?
Yes, I am, John. Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you for joining me.
And, my pleasure.
I wanted to talk to you about this because you are someone who has quite recently done this little exercise called the plaster effect, and you are living proof that it is indeed relatively easy to perceive the organic light, and that one can do it in ordinary circumstances and without resorting to the use of psychoactive substances.
Yes. Good. Yes, that's right.
Well, of course, that's good news, because when I wrote my book, Not in His Image, after the book came out, I should say, I was approached by a number of people with the question of how to perceive the organic light. Now, that was 5 years ago. The book came out in November of 2007. And for a couple of years after that time, I felt a little uncomfortable, because I didn't want to simply tell them, well, you have to you have to rely on the assistance of the plant allies, you have to take psychedelic mushrooms, you have to do a shamanic practice with sacred plants, and then the entities connected with those plants will lead you to the organic light. I felt uncomfortable giving that answer. I think you can understand why.
Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah, people would might have been uncomfortable doing it.
Yeah, some people may have serious observations about doing those kind of practices. Or, on the other hand, if they are inclined to do them, they may find it difficult because, in some cases, you're up against the law if
yes.
you mess around with those kinds of plants and those kinds of consciousness-changing substances.
Yes, yeah.
Nevertheless...
Sad but true.
Yeah, sad but true. Nevertheless, I felt they're almost as dangerous as raw milk, you know. Yeah. So, nevertheless, I felt, needless to say, a great sense of responsibility regarding how to answer that question. Those who have read my book, Not in His Image, will already know this. For those who haven't read it, I'd just like to point out that there was a vow of silence in the ancient mysteries. Not a vow of secrecy, a vow of silence. And there's a difference there. According to this vow of silence, those who entered the inner practices of the mysteries agreed that they would not go out into the world at large and speak openly in public about certain things that they saw and certain things that they experienced. It was not a tactic of secrecy in order to keep esoteric and occult knowledge from the public, whereby the better to manipulate them and things of that sort. That motivation has been wrongly attributed to people in the mysteries, as you know. No, rather it was there was a reason for that, which may become obvious as we proceed here to talk about what happens when you experience the organic light. The purpose of the vow of silence was to protect the nature of that experience, so that each person who came to it would come to it with a virgin possibility of discovery, not tainted and not biased by something that they had heard. While the situation is different today, and it is not only possible but necessary in our time to describe to people before they have the experience exactly what experience they're going to have, so that they can know what it is. And so, in a sense, I violated that vow of silence by speaking in my book very explicitly about the nature and behavior of this organic light.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever done that before, you know that.
Yes.
No one has ever made those details explicit. It was known from certain fragmentary information that survives from the classical world. It was known that the initiates at the consummate moment of the initiation process at Eleusis and elsewhere experienced some kind of miraculous light, some kind of illumination. But what exactly that was, what it looked like, how it appeared, those details were not given. And my book, Not in His Image, is in fact the first book that has ever been printed, to my knowledge, that actually gives those details and makes them public. It's a great privilege to be able to practice the telestic mysticism that allows you to go and encounter the organic light over and over again. And a lot of people today, of course, in modern life, will not have the opportunity to do that, but they do all have the opportunity to see the organic light by doing this simple exercise that you recently did. In order to launch us into the subject, I'd like to refer to something that you find on metahistory.org. If you go to the site and then you click on the banner that says Planetary Tantra, you come to the Planetary Tantra opening page. And then if you go to the left-hand column and choose Tantra Tour, there's a list of all the essays in that section. And if you go down to the very bottom, you'll see Severed Rose. And it's in 4 installments, so click on the first one. And this will bring you to a page called Severed Rose 1, which is 1945 to 1976. So what you find in Severed Rose is 2 things, basically. One is kind of a loose chronological description of some mystical experiences in my life. So you'll find, a loose account of some events in chronological order, beginning with my birth in 1945. The real purpose of writing these 4 parts of Severed Rose, with the fifth part to come, is to describe how I initially experienced the organic light without knowing what it was, and then to describe the long process throughout my life by which I came to terms with that experience and gradually, stage by stage, figured out what it actually was and understood it as, ultimately, understood it as being related to the divine Sophia, because it is her light, it is the presence and appearance of her body itself. But I didn't know that for a very, very long time. And so these 4 installments in my memoirs sort of trace the course of discovery in which I came to know what I can say today. Severed Rose number 1 gives the account, if you scroll down, of the first time that I perceived the organic light. And I want to point out that that was in Cambodia in 1965. And I was 19 years old. And I was wandering around the jungles near Angkor Wat in another great place called the Bayon, or Angkor Thom, where there are magnificent four-faced stupas with faces of bodhisattvas staring down at you. I think there's a total of 64 of them or something like that. And it was on the afternoon that I visited that place with my traveling companion at the time, Richard Lair, so I had a witness to what happened to me. And as we were pedaling back to Siem Reap, after having spent the afternoon at this ruined temple completely alone, we came across a group of Cambodian children who were bathing in an irrigation ditch. And even before we got close to them, I'm sure we must have been 150 or 250 feet away on our bicycles. My eyes went suddenly to one of the children wrapped in a sarong standing on the bank of this irrigation ditch. And I don't know why, but my eyes went to this child, a girl. And very curiously, the moment that they did so, a huge cry went up from the rest of the children. And the girl herself sort of panicked and, slipping and sliding, climbed up the embankment, holding her sarong around her, which was soaking wet, and started to run down the street toward a little town. There were just a handful of houses, and went into a house that was on poles over the embankment. And I chased her right into the house. It was completely crazy. I didn't know what I was doing. I pedaled like a maniac on my bicycle. I threw my bike to the ground, and in a running, still running, I went right into this private house until I was standing in a room, and she was about, 6 feet in front of me, 12-year-old Cambodian girl. And I couldn't understand what I was seeing, but I knew that it was real, and it's just as real to me today as it was then. From her forehead, there was a kind of emanation like taffy. It was a white substance, but it was like taffy, and it poured and streamed off her forehead toward me and reached me and then pooled around me, as it were, in a kind of like a pool of molten ivory. And that was the first time that I saw the organic light coming from the forehead of a 12-year-old Cambodian girl. So it was a pretty good introduction, really, when I look back on it.
Quite a story.
Yeah. And my friend Richard Lair saw it too. I know he did. And he was so beautifully sensitive about it, and so he was much more discreet than me. In fact, he came in to the house, and there was no one else in the house at the time, unless they were in a bedroom and I didn't see them. He came into the house and he very gently put his hand on my shoulder and said, John, you can't stay in here, simply because, you know, I had barged into this someone's house, which is just not a very good thing to do. And I turned to him and looked at him, and he shook his head and he said, "Yes, I know, but you can't stay in here." So he saw it too, you know, and it was really something I'll never forget. So that was the beginning, as I describe in the first installment of Severed Rose. But then jumping ahead, there was a moment in 1966 in India, the following year, actually, in Madras, India, when I saw the light again, and another moment in 1972 in a place called Kittitas, Washington, Central Washington. And those two experiences are described in an essay on MetaHistory.org called Honeycomb Light of the Christos. So to sum it all up and to get to what you experienced recently, Kundry, I just want to say that it is possible. Obviously, I'm an example of something that happened, that people can spontaneously see the organic light. And I'm sure I can't be the only person that has had that experience, you know. But others who may have had that experience in their lives in some quasi-miraculous way, like myself, would probably find themselves in the same position, wouldn't they? I mean, they just wouldn't know what it was, you know. They wouldn't be able to know. So in a great measure, my life here on this planet this time around And my mystical quest has been to understand exactly what it is and to be able to describe and communicate that to other people. Because it is obviously a wonderful thing if people do spontaneously encounter the organic light. A wonderful, wonderful thing, proving that the presence of the divine Sophia can break into our reality at any time. I know this has happened. Perhaps some people who will hear this recording will be able to testify to their own experience. A number of people have written me. A number of members of the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment have had this. But what we want to talk about today is how you can actually intentionally see it. And I understand that this is something that you did quite recently.
Yeah, just last week. Yep. Yeah, I had been, I was reading Severed Rose 3, and I read about the plaster effect, and so I thought, well, what the heck, I'm going to try it, you know. So I did exactly what you suggest, what you did. I went down, I turned out all the electric lights.
What time of day was this?
Oh, this was in the evening. This must have been around 10 o'clock at night. So I went down and, you know, lit a couple of candles, and I had them sort of behind me so the candlelight wasn't shining in my eyes. And then I just did what you write about in Severed Rose 3 about the plaster effect. And it didn't take very long when I started to see it.
So, and describe for us, if you will, the simple procedures of this exercise. You're in the dark, lit by soft candlelight, which is behind you. So you don't have any prominent light shining, no lamp is on or no outside street light is shining, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. The drapes were pulled so that the street lights were shut out. There were no electric lights on, just a couple of candles behind me so that I had no light shining into my eyes. And I sat on the couch and I got comfortable, and I let my eyes get used to the candlelight. And then I just did what you say in there. I unfocused my gaze and relaxed and just sort of, I was moving my gaze softly, this unfocused gaze, softly around the room. And I imagined that everything was made of white plaster and that the colors, you know, that the objects in the room were only, I was seeing them because they were stained different colors of plaster.
Right.
And it, like you're writing there, I was not visualizing. It was like I was in, this is hard to describe, but I was not visualizing. I was not seeing pictures.
Right.
Of this effect. I was like, it was 3D.
I see. Okay.
It's hard to describe because it's like you write in Severed Rose 3 there. It's not a visualization. It's more like an immersion in the imagining.
Okay. So.
And.
Go ahead.
Yes? Mm-hmm. Okay. And as I sat there with my gaze unfocused, in the soft candlelight, moving my eyes gently around the room, everything started to go white. And the colors of the things in the room, like the red of the upholstery of the rocker across the room, say, or the lamp and the plants, the colors began to fade, and it began to look like everything, like I was underwater in a tank of milk is what it looked like to me.
I see.
Like if I had, you know, in the old carnival dunk tanks, you know?
Right, right.
If I was on the seat and somebody hit the thing and I fell into this tank of milk and I was, and as I floated in there, I opened my eyes. That's what I would see.
Mm-hmm.
If the dunk tank was full of furniture, like a living room is.
Right.
And it was like looking through milk at the objects in the room.
But you didn't, in doing so, the objects did not in any way dissolve or lose their definition or become cloud-like or evanescent.
No.
No.
No. Mm-mm. Everything was there, just like normal. But it was like looking at them through milk, and like as if the room was full of milk and you were looking through it,
mm-hmm.
the plant on the table across the room or the rocker with its with its upholstery,
mm-hmm.
it would be there just as solid as it normally is,
right?
But the color, say like the red of the upholstery,
mm-hmm.
was like, it's hard to describe. It would be like faded, mm-hmm. because there would be this milkiness between you and it.
I see. So as the exercise is set up, when you're sitting there, in your case, you're sitting there, you're looking at a table, and on this table is a vase, for instance, okay? And by the table is an armchair. And according to the exercise to produce the so-called plaster effect, you're sort of saying in your mind, you're looking at the table and those three objects, the table, the vase on the table, and the chair, and they all have their normal three-dimensional presence. They're massive, they're solid.
Mm-hmm.
But as you look at them, you are saying in your mind, what I am seeing is a plaster sculpture. All these things are made of plaster. The table, the chair, and the vase, which appear to be separate objects, are all molded out of one mm-hmm. mass of plaster. And the mm-hmm. reason why they appear to be distinct and to have their own color and shape is simply because of the way the plaster has been stained.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But that mm-hmm. would be when that this is like the way that you speak to your mind, as it were, in order to set up the experience, right?
Yes, huh? Yes.
Now, how long did you have to speak to your mind in that way before this perception started to dawn on you? Did it take 20 minutes or 10 minutes?
Or? No, it was really very fast. 5 or 7 minutes, something like that.
Really?
Yeah, it was really very fast.
And once the impression came on, let's say once you were able to perceive that there was something else present here that was of a luminous nature, were you then able to look around the room, to look mm-hmm. to the right and left, and to still maintain that impression?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I wasn't staring.
Mm-hmm.
My gaze was unfocused, and I allowed my unfocused gaze to softly roam around the room.
I see.
And every time I focus my eyes, you know, because you kind of, you know, that's kind of like an involuntary thing almost, you know, you focus, that's, you lose it then.
I see.
It's the unfocused gaze.
So keeping the gaze unfocused is an important factor in maintaining it when it comes on.
Yes.
I see. Okay. Yes. Well, that's a very good point because, you know, one of the reasons why we don't perceive the organic light is it's really very simple. You know, if we learn the truth about this phenomenon, which is that it is constantly present all the time, it is before us, it is around us, we are immersed in it, that is the truth, and that is a physical truth. It's just as true as saying that we are immersed in oxygen all the time. Mm-hmm. You see? It's a physical truth. But why then don't we see it? Well, as creatures with eyes, as animals walking around the planet with a set of eyes, we are accustomed to orient to our environment through the way our eyes function, through the rods and the cones, and it's a beautiful instrument, the optical instrument of the human being, very beautiful, but it is adapted to a certain kind of light. It is our eyes and the way they function are adapted to the light in the atmosphere, which is produced by an interaction between the solar rays and the constituents of the atmosphere itself. And so, as we all know, I'm standing right here now looking out the window at the valley, looking south toward the straits, and I see the mountains and the rolling hills. I see a town in the distance. I see the oak trees in the foreground. I see my terrace, and I see all that because there is a transparent radiant substance that is shining on it, which is light. But the light itself is apparently immaterial and transparent. I can't see the light. I see what the light shows me, but I don't see the light itself. Well, This is how our eyes are trained to function. They are used to seeing and receiving the totally transparent light in the atmosphere, which then allows us to see objects. And so, even though the organic light is there, our eyes don't have the habit of seeing it, because it makes itself appear in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yes, very much. Very much so.
And so when you do see it, well, how was it? I mean, is it a jarring sight? Is it, like, breathtaking? Is it...
No, it was just, it came on very gently, and... Of course, I realized what I was seeing when I saw it, and I was delighted to be able to see it, and, you know, delighted to know that I was, you know, what I was seeing, I kind of said hello to her, you know, no, it wasn't, it wasn't some huge emotional impact. Anything overwhelming.
Would you say it was intriguing?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because the longer I sat there, the more things going on in it I saw.
Right. So as you stay with the exercise, you have the opportunity to stabilize that perception, right? Well, that's what happened to me in ARC, as I described this in Severed Rose. I don't know if it's in 2 or 3. I can't remember. I guess it's in... it's in Severed Rose 4, actually, which is titled Infinity Ridge. I describe when I did what you have just recently done. Mm-hmm. I was sitting in the evening in May of the year 2000 in a little shepherd's cabin that I had rented on a hillside above the little town of Ark in the Cathar country of southern France. And Ark is very near Rennes-le-Château, which is the town that is famous for the Magdalene connection to Jesus Christ. In fact, the so-called tomb of Jesus, the Poussin tomb, where he was said to be buried, according to that theocratic fairy tale, was at the entrance to the town of Arc, and it was in a farmer's field until the farmer destroyed it because so many people were tramping around trying to sniff the bones of Jesus over there. So, you know, I was within a stone's throw of that place. And I actually looked down on the hilltop town of Rennes-le-Château from where I was staying. So, and I do look down on Rennes-le-Château, by the way, both in the symbolic and other senses. And it was a warm spring evening, and I was sitting in an old, clumpy old armchair. It was a furnished cabin that I had rented. And I don't think I had the fire going that night because it wasn't so cold. I had a couple of candles on, like you. And there was a wall. One of the walls of it was a stone wall. It was an old stone hut, a shepherd's hut. But the wall had been covered with some kind of plaster, actually. But it was not white plaster. It was sort of gray. And I sat there in the room in the semi-darkness, and I looked at that wall with a soft gaze. And I think the way that I like to describe it, Kundry, is to say this is an exercise of auto-suggestion. Mm-hmm. You don't really visualize or picture anything because that would be forcing something on the experience.
That's right.
Yeah. What you do is I just suggested to myself. Mm-hmm. I suggested to my mind. I said, okay, mind, I want you to act as if what I'm seeing is all just one mass of plaster. This entire room was made of plaster. The bookshelves, the table where I eat my little dinner, the fireplace, the wood stove, and the chimney that goes up from the wood stove. I turned and looked at the chimney that went up from the wood stove, the stovepipe, and I said, that stovepipe is actually molded out of plaster. Everything in this room is molded out of one piece of plaster. And the only reason why the things look like they do is because they're stained with a particular color. Mm-hmm. And I gave my mind that suggestion to see things that way. And I remember that I had to reinforce that suggestion a few times. In other words, when I looked at the stovepipe, I told my mind that it was plaster. And then when I turned and looked at the other part of the room at the doorway, I told my mind that the door frame going into the little kitchen was plaster. And I think not very long, I think for maybe 5 or 10 minutes, certainly no longer than that, I did just that. I just reinforced that suggestion. And very, very soon, I noticed that I was seeing something that I hadn't noticed before. Something was catching my attention, but it was very subtle. It was subtle. And then I realized, well, actually, it does look that way. It does look that way because there is a white substance that's underlying everything that's here. And then as I continued to gaze, it's exactly the way you describe it, more and more softly moving my eyes over things, then I definitely felt, I would say, a certain kind of buoyancy, a lightness. Mm-hmm. And I realized that the entire room, and this is not a façon de parler, this is not an expression, but literally, the entire room was floating in this subtle white mass of light.
That's exactly right. Yep.
And then I continued to stay there calmly and stayed there for quite a long time that evening. And that exercise, which I did and which you've done recently and which anyone can do, was a mystical experience of the alchemists of the Middle Ages. They called the organic light the philosopher's stone. And the reason why they called it a stone is obvious when you see what it actually is. Mm-hmm. By calling it a stone, they were referring to the fact, the miraculous and mysterious and awesome fact, that it is material.
Yes.
Yeah. So when you were able to detect that fact that this light is material.
Oh yeah. Yeah. If it wasn't material, we wouldn't be able to see it.
Right. Right. And would you say that this simple exercise, if you do it steadily, allows you to see, because this is the thing that really can trip the mind. It allows you to see that this light doesn't shine on things.
Absolutely. No.
Which is what we expect light to do, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this light doesn't shine on things, does it?
Mm-mm. No, it doesn't shine on things at all. That's not what it is. That's not how it looks. It comes from things.
That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. It wells up from things.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look long enough and steadily enough without straining, you see something before your eyes that is, in normal terms, completely miraculous. You see that all the material masses that we move around with in this world, the walls, the doors, the chairs, you know, are all floating in something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, we move through it because we're made of it.
Yes, we ourselves must also be floating in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there is the question of so-called empty space. You're sitting in a room. There are objects. There are walls, ceiling, floor. But there is also the empty space of the room. Now, does this radiance, this soft white radiance, flow into the empty space of the room? Did that happen in your experience?
No. No, it doesn't flow into. There is no such thing as empty space.
But it just, doesn't. Right, but just hold on for a minute. In your perception, did you observe that the light that you saw as this soft white luminosity coming through things, did you see it in any way flowing into the empty space of the room, the so-called empty space?
Well, flow into, it implies coming from someplace, you know, into an empty area. That's not how I perceived it. As I sat there, it was already there. It didn't come from anywhere. It didn't flow into the space.
Mm-hmm.
It.
So it couldn't be described as shining either. It doesn't.
No,
does it shine?
Doesn't. No, it doesn't shine.
This is true. It does not shine in my experience.
Mm-mm, it doesn't. No, it does not shine.
Right, but it glows.
Yes. Yes. It is glow.
And when you were able to observe that soft white glow, did you observe anything in it? Was it flat? Did it move? Did it have some kind of activity? What were you able to observe?
It has soft opalescent colors in it, like soft blue, soft pink, soft yellow, moving in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like an abalone shell. It's like a kind of iridescence. But it, again, it's not a shining. It's an iridescence within the light.
Mm. Ah, very, very interestingly said. An iridescence within the light. It's internally mm-hmm. luminous and iridescent.
Yes, right. with soft opaly colors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good point of description. I just want to take a moment here to make a distinction that may be helpful to some people. It is absolutely well known beyond question and massively supported by testimony that mystical experiences all through the ages have been accompanied by some kind of perception of light, where the word Buddha means the one who is enlightened. Enlightenment means you've seen the light. Illumination means that you've seen something radiant, something in the nature of a of a light, of a flash, or of some kind of brilliance. And so there are many, many records throughout history of mystics and also ordinary individuals who have had extraordinary experiences of light. You know, it's even said, for instance, that the, if you read the fairy tale of the New Testament, it says that Saul on the way to Damascus was overcome by a blinding light and so forth and so on. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
These people who are listening now may be among those many individuals who have had these experiences of light, who have had some kind of shock of illumination of one kind or another. But what I want to point out to you, and this is such a wonderful thing to know, don't believe me and don't take it on my authority, but just consider very closely the distinction that I'm now going to make. You can put all of those experiences of illumination that are reported into one category. And you can put the experience of the organic light in a separate category.
Mm-hmm.
Because the experience of the organic light is not like any other experience of mystic illumination. And several people have asked me this question through the years. They have described experiences of light that they had, or being plunged into light as if you were in a room filled with blinding light bulbs and you're standing there in that massive brilliance, you know, experiences like that. I don't know if you've had any other experiences of light in the course of your life of that nature.
No, not like that.
Well, many people have, you know that. Mm-hmm. It's relatively common. What is really important to distinguish that those experiences, whatever they are, I'm not dismissing them and I'm not even commenting on what they are, but they are not experiences of the organic light.
That's right.
Now, when I was early on, when I discovered Autobiography of a Yogi by Yogananda, I was tremendously shocked because in one chapter he describes Kundalini. And I had Kundalini experiences, which were also accompanied by brilliant flashes of light, like electrical discharges of lightning. And I had the full type of cosmic consciousness experience of samadhi that comes with that. And there was Yogananda, this traditional Hindu yogi, describing exactly what I had experienced, and I was really blown away when I found that book. But I must add that in Yogananda's experiences and in the accounts of countless other Hindu mystics and mystics from various cultures, I did not find descriptions that corresponded to my experience of the organic light. I found these other experiences of illumination. And I was very, very happy at one point when I was reading the works of Sir John Woodruff. He was a British scholar who did a lot to translate tantric, Hindu tantric texts and to present Hindu tantricism to the West. In fact, he was the main interpreter. He wrote The Serpent Power, The World as Power, The Garland of Letters, and many other books about Hindu tantra. And he was like my mainstay for many years and a source of a great deal of valuable teachings. And I was delighted when I finally found in John Woodruff a description that corresponded to the organic light. And I just want to read that for a second because it's so rare. He says, this is taken from a text called The Ocean of Nectar, which is a Shakta text, that is to say, a text from the people who worship Shakti, that is to say, the divine feminine.
Mm-hmm.
The text says, this is the pearl which those who have churned the ocean of Tantra discover. That pearl is there in an Indian shell. There is a beautiful nacre on the inner shell, which is the mother of pearl. Outside, the shell is naturally rough and coarse and bears the accretions of weed and parasite and of all things which exist, good or bad as we call them, in the ocean of existence, or samsara. The scripture of Tantra leads us to remove these accretions. Finally, it leads us to seek and see the mother of pearl, and lastly, the pearl itself, which, enclosed within, shines with the brilliant yet soft light, which is that of the moon chit. End quote. That is a remarkable paragraph.
Yeah.
It's almost unique in my readings of mystical literature from many cultures, because it describes, well, there is your nacre, there is the iridescent blossoming of colors within the light. And it also says explicitly that this is a brilliant yet soft light and that it resembles pearl or moonlight. And those are exactly the ways that I would describe it from my direct experience as well.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There is nothing flashing about it. It doesn't flash. It doesn't blind. It doesn't, it doesn't, there's none of that. None of that. It's brilliant yet soft.
Now,
the softness is.
Yes, go ahead.
The softness is, yeah, the softness is. How do I? It's so soft. It's so gentle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, when I had the stabilization of the light at ARC, which in alchemical terms is called attaining the stone. I was impressed by these qualities that you describe. Exactly, Jill. And I will say to those who want to undertake this experience that one of the really wonderful things about this divine experience, this divine opportunity, is that it's the same for everyone. Mm-hmm. Now, those other mystical experiences are not that way. Those other mystical experiences of light, for whatever reason they happen, and whatever illumination they may bring, opening the heart, opening the mind, whatever, are all diverse and subjective and subject to a great many different variations depending on who has them and who and how they are interpreted. But to be in the presence of the organic light is not like that. It is the ultimate unity of truth, both of the mystical and physical worlds, because it is the one thing that we can all agree on. It is absolutely the same for everyone.
Yeah, you don't have to believe anything.
You don't have to believe it. You can see it with your own eyes. And as you see it and as you contemplate it, various qualities of it become more evident. And then I am totally convinced that people who compare their experiences, as you and I are doing now, will come to the same conclusions about what they perceived. For instance, I don't know, because this is only the first time you did this, right? Have you done it several times since then, or have you just done it once?
Yeah, no, I did it I did it 3 times.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you might have observed, as you continue to do it, anything that you could call like a texture.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Except for that.
That is soft.
That soft.
Yeah.
That it's soft.
Well, it's interesting because the word soft is kind of a clue to texture, because of course it has a double meaning. First of all, the light is soft. Meaning,
right, but that's not what I mean.
Right.
I mean that it's like pillowy.
Pillowy. Yes.
It's pillowy. Yeah.
That's
or
right.
Like. Yeah. Like. Oh, like the most luxurious down comforter you could imagine, or I mean, It feels soft.
It feels soft.
No, I guess that...
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
That's right. It feels soft. And my experience was to be captivated by its primary quality, which is this deep interior luminosity which reaches the eyes and feels soft. And then the more that I look at it, I feel that the light itself has a texture. And in Not in His Image, I describe that texture as marshmallow. And it might seem like a curious comparison, but I have to say that it's really looks like it could be made out of marshmallow. It really does. And the reason why it looks that way is because it is a material mass. This is the thing that the mind can't get, you see. This is where the mind blocks itself, because our eyes, neither our eyes nor our minds, are trained to see light as a material, substantial mass. It's solid. In fact, one of the names that the alchemists call it, the Philosopher's Stone, they had many, many names for it. But another name that they called it, which is really amazing, that the alchemists had to make up words to describe this fantastic presence, and they called it the Sophic Hydrolith. Well, Sophic comes from the word Sophia, and by calling it Sophic, they meant that it is a source of wisdom, that it is a teacher, that it is an intelligence. Hydrolith is a made-up term from hydro meaning water and lith meaning stone. So Sophic Hydrolith means the water stone of wisdom, you see? And this shows the extent to which the medieval alchemist who had the experience of the light, which is also identical with the Holy Grail, and is the true and ultimate meaning of the Grail, I might add, the extent to which they went to try to describe the qualities and properties of this light, you know?
The softness is really hard to describe because not only does it look soft, but that's not what I'm talking about. The softness that I'm talking about is the sensation.
Right, right.
Of the light.
Right.
On your body.
Right, on your body. Coming to you. Yeah, coming to you. So.
Yeah, like if you could go up in a cloud and roll around in a cloud as if it were a down comforter that is enveloping your whole body. And it's, you know, just the softest thing. And it's so hard to describe.
It's no, you describe it very well. And in fact, that analogy is an excellent one. I can't fly in an airplane now and sit there looking out the window at those perfectly white billowing clouds without thinking of the organic light. I can't, because that's exactly what it looks like. And I am certain that the Divine Sophia herself, the planetary animal mother, provides us with a vision of clouds. She provides us with clouds as part of the natural symbiosis of the atmosphere, obviously. But I wonder if she might not have a second purpose in providing us with a vision of clouds. Because that vision of clouds is like showing us, hey, hey, look at this. I am here, and this is what I look like. I'm here. You know, I just want to point out, we're getting to the end of this little recording. And I want to point out, for those who go into this experience, that you have the opportunity to know it in a way that even the initiates in the mystery school did not know it. You have the opportunity to know beforehand what you're going to see. Now, in the past, that wasn't allowed because it was thought that it would queer the experience. And it was true. It was correct for the method of that time. But today, it's different. Today, it is proper and allowable to know what you're going to see before you know it. And to make this perfectly clear, I explain in Not in His Image that we can think of the divine Sophia as having two bodies. One of them is her planetary body. She is actually present in the planet and embodied in the planet. So the earth, the rocks, the rivers, the oceans, the mountains, the clouds, all of this is actually her planetary body, and it's the physical embodiment of her organic light from the Pleroma. But as the Asian mystics taught us, even when the divine transforms itself into a material apparition, it does not lose its primary nature of luminosity. So while she is, on the one hand, the visible planet of sensory elements, of physical elements, she is also present in her primary substance body. And that is what you see when you see the organic light. You see the naked body of the white goddess. You see her pleromic radiance.
Yeah.
It comes to you softly at first. Very softly. And so I wanted to make that distinction, Kundry, because we're at almost at an hour. I don't want to make this interview go any longer, but we discussed the option to go to a second interview in which we could talk more about these qualities and properties of the organic light. And in the second interview, we would also talk about what happens when you have a more, what shall we say, close encounter?
Yes.
And let's say when she gets to be a little bit more outrageous with you.
Yes.
Because it must be admitted that in the plaster effect, she comes on very soft and sweet. But she's also capable of being, let's say, rather more flagrant in the way that she reveals herself.
Yeah.
So perhaps we could follow this talk up with a second one in which we would describe our experience here together on the terrace twice, if you'd be willing to do that and if you'd enjoy that.
Oh, yes, I would very much.
Okay, we shall do that very soon.
Right.
And I send out my confidence to the people who hear this talk, because as Kundry says, and she is my witness on this occasion, this is really very easy to do.
It is.
And we need to know from the testimony of Kundry, myself, and others that she is accessible and that we have seen her. And I extend my confidence to you to have that experience. And then when you do so, the confidence of the experience becomes your own. And this is what the mystics called the pistis sophia. Pistis meaning confidence in Greek. The confidence of the goddess is that we know that she is present. She is there. She's there for us, as we say in the American idiom. And all we have to do is show up and be there for her. And it's wonderful to know that that experience is available in our day and age. So it's delightful to talk about this with you, Kundry, and we'll pick it up very soon.
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. With pleasure.
Okay. Thank you very much, my friend.
Okay. You're welcome, John.